Thank you. And could I now turn to the moderator of our next panel, Professor Dr. Kleiber.
Dear colleagues, welcome to the next session. I'm sure in advance that it will again be a very interesting session. We start with Mr. Adam Bement, Director of the U.S. National Science Foundation. Mr. Nadia.
Well, good afternoon, and greetings from the National Science Foundation. I'm delighted to be able to speak at this workshop on rebuilding the transatlantic bridge between U.S. and Polish cooperation. First of all, as we discuss rebuilding bridges, I think it's important to recognize the long-standing and firm foundation that the relationship between Poland and the United States has had for many years, and to acknowledge that a keystone of that relationship is Poland's proud history and tradition of scientific inquiry and innovation. Poland's many contributions to the world's body of scientific knowledge had an early boost with the stunning achievements of Nicholas Copernicus, whose work on the revolutions of the celestial spheres is regarded not only as the starting point of modern astronomy, but also the genesis of the scientific revolution that continues to this day. And all of this happened centuries before the Declaration of Independence was even a gleam in our founders' eyes. Moreover, the world is indebted to the many, many Americans of Polish heritage who have made their mark in science, engineering, and medicine at the highest levels, a group that includes at least 5 Nobel laureates in economics, medicine, chemistry, and physics. Today in Poland and in the United States, we stand ready to build upon our dual legacies as Poland prepares for a heightened leadership position in Europe and in science and engineering. The National Science Foundation has a deep and abiding interest in working with the Polish scientific and engineering community. We are enthusiastically working with officials in Poland as they work to realize their vision for a robust science and engineering support infrastructure. Currently, the Polish Parliament is considering legislation that would create an NSF-like research funding organization in Poland. Also of central importance to moving Poland toward the forefront of the European science and engineering enterprise are measures pending in Parliament to liberalize the technology transfer program for small businesses and efforts to reform the national system of higher education. Meanwhile, Poland is developing the necessary climate to cultivate a world-class research workforce. The Private Foundation for Polish Science supports a variety of competitive ventures aimed at encouraging innovation and excellence. The Welcome Project, for example, recruits exemplary researchers to come to Poland by offering 5-year, $2 million pay and benefits packages to attract the best available scientific talent to Polish institutions of higher education. NSF is interested in helping Polish researchers connect with their expatriate colleagues in the United States to invigorate the circulation of ideas and scientific collaborations between our two nations. While NSF by law is permitted only to fund research conducted by U.S. researchers, we can encourage those researchers who have left Poland and have come to live in the United States to forge collaborative ties with their colleagues in Poland to the benefit of both nations. Such projects, to use a U.S. colloquialism, is a win-win situation. The strength of the NSF system lies in the merit review of largely unsolicited proposals submitted by U.S. researchers themselves. In this way, we are able to fund and to take advantage of ideas that scientists deem to be of high scientific merit rather than in response to top-down solicitations. One such project that is very germane to this audience is a U.S.-Poland International Research Experience for Students grant, which we call IRES, I-R-E-S, to Andrzej Nowak at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. This project will provide an international research experience for graduate and undergraduate students from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and Florida A&M University. The grant has two overarching goals. First, to formalize international research training for U.S. undergraduate and graduate students in the field of civil infrastructure systems, and secondly, to nurture the development of strong professional relationships between European Union engineers, in this case, Polish engineers, and U.S. engineers. The project leader, in conjunction with a faculty advisor, selects a specific research topic. The team identifies the project, formulates the activities, and coordinates with each other and the Polish engineers involved. During their annual 6-week technical tour of Poland, the teams closely collaborate with leading researchers at top universities and, at the same time, attend a civil infrastructure conference and tour large-scale European civil infrastructure-related projects. Again, this is a win-win for both of us as we introduce the upcoming generation of U.S. and Polish engineers to international cooperation. We must also recognize that the United States, Poland, and all nations of the world are today competing in a global marketplace for innovation. Developed and developing countries alike must recognize that economic growth in a knowledge economy is driven by investments in research, education, and information and communication infrastructures. Therefore, it is more essential than ever that leaders in science and engineering foster collaborations with researchers and educators in other countries. The price of not doing so is to miss the opportunities for leveraging beneficial emerging technologies and discoveries. NSF has been active in building the cyber infrastructure that allows scientists and engineers to form virtual research and education networks. Most importantly, these virtual networks are not limited by discipline or geography. They are able to integrate a diversity of skills and talent from a variety of nations simultaneously. This is the logical response to the variety and quantity of data emerging from a greatly expanding cyber world. This sophisticated cyber infrastructure and its cooperative use will be essential for Poland and all nations that seek to compete in the global research marketplace. Last but most critical, we all must realize that the world faces four critical challenges that are interdependent and urgently in need of new solutions. First, we need to more accurately predict the effects of climate change and devise ways to mitigate them without doing further ecological harm. Secondly, we need to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels by devising sustainable alternatives. Third, we need simultaneously to maintain national prosperity. And finally, we need to educate a global workforce that is equipped to understand the interrelationships among these first three issues and take an active part in meeting the challenge. At NSF, we are putting specific focus on the disappearing boundaries between and among scientific disciplines and on ways to explore the critical interactions and feedback among complex systems. Only then can we transform the ways in which we think about modeling the effects of climate change, make changes to mitigate those effects, engineer alternative energy storage and delivery systems, and train a new generation to build on those innovations and further improve them. This is an agenda that we look forward to working with our colleagues in Poland. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bement. We really so much appreciate your being with us and giving the presentation. We could accommodate a question or two now. We shall be able to come back to this speech at the end of the session, but okay, we'll do that. And yes, we have a question.
Just a quick question: are these programs that you mentioned, collaborative programs with Poland, are these subject to normal peer review?
Under the means of our collaborations, we operate under a true partnership. In other words, the proposers of the research will submit their proposals to the respective research councils. In our case, U.S. scientists will submit their proposals to the National Science Foundation. and we have a high regard for merit review in other countries. And once those proposals are approved, then we each fund our own side of the collaboration. And it's so simple. All it takes is for a researcher in Poland to get together with a researcher in the United States to decide what they want to do and write a proposal. And if it has high scientific merit, and if it can be peer-reviewed and found to be meritorious, then it's our job to try and find the funding, the resources to support the research.
Maybe the practical question here, and just so do you have a special call with a specific amount of money you can ask for?
Do you want to know that answer? Absolutely not. No, we have a thing against earmarking, and we not only like earmarking in the U.S. Congress, we don't like earmarking within the National Science Foundation either.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, we have another question.
Does the researcher have to be a not-for-profit organization in the States, or could it be a for-profit group?
It should be non-for-profit, preferably a national institution, research institute, or a university.
Yes, we have another question.
Some special cases, we can provide some sort some support for local expenses for a scientist visiting a scientist here in the United States. Generally, however, it wouldn't cover a plane fare.
Would it cover salary?
And it would not cover salary. Oh, but by the way, you know, these arrangements are commonly arrived at by universities themselves, so oftentimes it's up to the university to make those decisions, not the National Science Foundation. So if there's a visiting scientist on campus, that would be a possibility for a university to support if that scientist is contributing to the university's research program. Furthermore, there's enough flexibility in some of our programs that we can support postdocs and graduate students in that way.
Yes. The question is, what is the new strategy of President Obama and the way you participate? Oh.
Yes, it was almost serendipitous that once we received the Obama-Biden plan for science and technology during the campaign, and shortly after they were elected to office, we discovered that we had anticipated them very well and that we were almost perfectly aligned with all the priorities that they had identified, especially research in climate change, support for young investigators, an increased number of graduate research fellowships, and research in renewable energy technologies. Now, our role is not necessarily to, it's not at all to supplant research that should be supported by the Department of Energy, but in looking at frontier research, frontier science that may lead to the next generation of technologies, that's where we feel our role is, upstream from addressing current problems.
Thank you. I think, as far as I know, Dr. Berman has to leave now for a while, but we'll be back towards the end of the session. So my suggestion is that all of us who still would like to ask a question get prepared for later. I think we move on now to the second presentation, which will be given by Professor Zmijewski of the Warsaw University of Technology. I must say, Professor Zmijewski lost his luggage on the way somewhere in London. So before you take the floor, please accept our wishes to fast recover your belongings. And luckily enough, I think his precious presentation was traveling with him in the cabin and not in the luggage. So
thank you very much. This was the remark I plan to start with my presentation, explaining that my British outlook is not because I'm from Oxford or Cambridge, because I fly with British Airways. That's the reason. So, but firstly, I should thanks to the President Kleiber for being invited here and to the Minister of Economy for sending me here. Well, so, and now I can start with my presentation, which is about the efficiency. And you have heard the fantastic presentation from Mr. Trojanowska and Mr. Montes about the nuclear power, about the carbon capture and storage. Those are fantastic technologies, but, well, we will have them perhaps not earlier than the year 2020 or maybe a little bit later. And to the moment when we reach this other bank of paradise, we have to cross the river. And we have to find a way how to cross the river and how to find our place in energy policy, and perhaps I hope that's the solution. And I should say that I'm known as a so-called independent expert, but here and today I represent national public board of National Emission Reduction Program, which the deputy president is present here, and the president of this body, which is created by the Prime Minister Pavlak, is our former Prime Minister Jerzy Buzek. So it's I'm a boy rider in this high level company, but I think it's one of the most important thing for Poland is to find the way to reduce emission and to raise the efficiency. We were born black, and you know about it. And that's our position of a CO2 emission per thousand of euro of gross domestic product. Unfortunately, we are not the leaders here. And this is our position on the use of primary energy for a million euro of gross domestic product. Unfortunately, we are also not very good in this competition. But we really go green. So, as Mr. Pavlak says, we want to go to the green side of power. And it's not a joke. It's not a joke. I made two drawings. This one is the comparison with Japan, as perhaps you know that in energy efficiency, Japan is the world leader. And this is emission per capita. And from the year 2090, we are better. Which means that we have changed something. And it's not only of the third crisis. It's because of the general changes in our economy, which is called transmission. But it was hard job. And another comparison is between Poland and Japan on its emission per thousand dollar of gross domestic product. As you can see, we are approaching, and perhaps we can meet this level of the year 2025 or 30. So this is something, because we were 4.5 times worse than the average in the European Union. Now it's 2.3, and we want to catch European Union in the year 2025. So maybe we are not the cleanest, but we are the fastest. Okay. Objectives is, from the Polish perspective, is improvement of energy efficiency of the Polish economy, and that's obvious. The EU perspective is a little bit different. Different is a significant reduction of CO2 emission, and there is a question, is it a dilemma or synergy? This is a comparison of the European and Poland use of primary energy, and Europe says that it's going to reduce this use about 20% according to business as usual. And so this, that means if you compare with the year 2005 is 16.5, and if we use the same reduction for Poland is 78 million of ton of oil equivalent, which means that it's a really significant requirement, and of course yet it's only moral one. There is no directive which forces us to do that, but we should think that it'll be necessary if you want to compete on the global market, because the energy is the cost, is the price. And it's not energy at the moment, it's also the emission rights. So we have two drivers. One is energy efficiency directive, which asks us to reduce end-use energy about 4.5 million ton of oil equivalent, which is about 9%. And the other one is a famous 3x20 program, which asks us to reduce the use of primary energy about 20%. Well, about this directive, it's to remove existing market barriers and market imperfections and to develop and promote energy efficiency market, those two things. And we should understand that a national program of emission reduction is necessary because we are in a quite new situation. The cost of CO2 allowances, the right to breathe, in fact, is going to be higher than the cost of the fuel. Fuel is easy to buy, but to have allowances is a problem. So, we have to think about national energy efficiency program. We have to think about national program of renewable energy, and especially agriculture, energy-oriented agriculture, and national clean coal program. If we think about the year 2020, if we think about 2030, we should also think about the national program for the nuclear power. National Energy Efficiency Program, those two drivers, it's 9% by the year 2016 and 20% by the year 2020. And some support mechanism, and one of those, the most important perhaps, is energy efficiency certificates. That's the Energy Efficiency Act. This 9 points is already in the project of the bill, which is now at the very last phase of elaboration in the government. So we hope in the next couple of weeks it will be laid in the parliament. The 3, 10, 11, and 12 is something which perhaps will be added in the future, especially Energy Agency and Energy Efficiency Fund. I hope it will happen. Well, if we have 9 from 12 is quite good. That's which shows energy efficiency targets, rules of support to energy services, and financial legal frameworks, and all mechanisms, incentives to support energy efficiency in the country. The main mechanism is a white certificate scheme, which is aimed at reduction of energy consumption, increase of energy generation efficiency in auxiliary services, and reduction of losses in transmission and distribution. And those property of rights will be tradable on the power exchange. Some basic information about this scheme is a catalog of pro-efficiency investments, obligatory energy audit or energy efficiency audit, and number of allocated energy efficiency certificates determined as a result of the primary emission tender procedure, which optimized the cost of the whole system. The tender is announced by the President of Energy Regulatory Office. So we have three dimensions. One is value-related foundation, which is, creates a price ceiling, redemption obligation, substitution fee, and financial penalty. So if you don't want to buy, you can pay, and if you don't want to pay, you have to pay a penalty. That's very simple. Sales guarantee, which is registration, tradability, the power exchange or over the counter, and index creation possibility. And the quality is emission tender, three packages is three floors, and energy audit is three floors is final use, generation, and transmission. Results is improved energy efficiency of the Polish economy and achievement of significant shortening of simple payback period for the investor, because if it is not accepted by the investor, of course, it is not worth anything. It shows two paths of a low and high scenario. Perhaps we will introduce this low scenario with something like 1 million, or maybe a little bit less, of the savings yearly. Well, this is analysis of the cost of perhaps the savings for the low scenario, and this shows this shortened investment payback time, which shows that perhaps it will be something like 1.5 years for the business. Because that kind of investments in Poland, energy efficiency investment, usually have the something like 5 years payback time. So if we shorten it by 1.5, it's a significant motivation for the investor. And this shows some mechanism or kitchen of this system, which shows that it is possible even to save more energy than is certified. So we pay less for more, which is always very nice situation. And voluntary commitment is another tool which could be utilized, not so sufficient, but nice from the, how to say, the point of view of creation of the conscious, of the social conscious. And that's results and conclusions. The results in reduction of CO2 emission is 70 million by the year 2016 and 33 million by the year 2020, and the same with primary energy consumption and end use energy consumption. It doesn't mean that it solves every problem in the country, of course not, but let's say it solves half, and half is something, is much more better than nothing. This shows perhaps the future of the market of the power of the energy with different certificates. We already have green for renewables, we have red for cogeneration, we have yellow for gas and small CHP. I hope we will have white for efficiency, and I think we will need orange for zero emission like CCS or nuclear power, because it's a little bit more costly than the typical traditional power plant, and maybe also a blue for super generation, a generation with the efficiency higher than 50%. A few years ago we have only one color, it was colorless, nothing. So we develop steadily, step by step. This is the slogan here, keeps the dreams cost low, because that's a way to optimize the cost of energy policy. Of course, we can do it in the way, let us market decide. But market usually only pays for the cheapest solution. And it's not always that we want to have a cheapest solution. Conclusions. First, we are not the richest, but we want to develop. And that's why we have to optimize the cost. Second, everybody should have a chance to try but the best ones should win. And the winning criteria, of course, should be published and publicly discussed. And the third conclusion, and that's the last one, the competitors are market companies, but there is nothing wrong in openly seeking for profit. I hope so. Well, the process should be transparent, and if it is transparent, it's okay. Please remember, 20 years ago, we have socialism in our country, so that's why. And that's the end of my presentation. Efficiency is the key. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the interesting presentation, which clearly demonstrates how complex the issue these days is in terms of controlling and paying for emissions. I actually invite questions from the audience. Yes, we have one.
Sorry, I've been in and out today, but the most dramatic things I've heard were the reminder that 90%, over 90% of your electricity comes from coal. And then to see a graph that's as remarkable as you've shown in terms of the CO2 per economic activity is really dramatic. You've talked about some of the institutional mechanisms and processes, but can you connect the dots a little more? For example, when you're generating that much of your electricity from coal, what are some of the steps that have brought that CO2 emission per economic activity so low? I mean, to me, it's remarkable.
In fact, it's a crucial question. Thank you for the question. The explanation is, I think, pretty simple, and it is the explanation we gave to the House of Lords together with Professor Buzek. They, in England, they have much more white colors and we have much more blue colors. When we reduce the number of the blue colors, which is a very, very difficult process, then we improve the global efficiency and the global emission. Because the cement factory, even the best cement factory are in Poland, by the way, in terms of emission of CO2. But usually, cement factory emits much more than bank. So if we have more banks, less cement factories, our emission and energy efficiency is better. But it's not an easy job to close cement factories because you have to do something with the workers.
And also you might need the cement.
And using this remark, please remember that the United Kingdom, it's not because of my luggage, of course, but United Kingdom reduce emission by 11%, but the main mechanism was to send production abroad or overseas, as they say, to the Pakistan for the cement and for other goods to China. That's very, very simple process, but it doesn't help to the total global warming effect, right? So we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes.
In order to incentivize the key players in the carbon gas trading markets, you need to develop some underlying ICT, information communication technologies, to make their reporting feasible and make it as close as possible to real time. Is there anyone in Poland working on, let's say, the virtual markets to make the carbon exchanges a reality? For example, real-time reporting from major polluters that can trade carbon gas emissions and then trade also the credits and the other information that's pertinent to the markets. Is there anyone working along those lines?
Frankly, I haven't heard about it, but I understand your intervention like that you candidate to the national, to the public board
for the National Program of Emission Reduction as a consultant, because this is the task of the board to present to the government what should be done in this field. Thank you very much for this remark.
Thank you. Yes, we have another question, please.
Maybe I'll also use this microphone. I'm sorry for that position that I'm speaking from. In all your presentation, I have heard a lot about financial penalties for emissions, for misbehavior in terms of energy. I don't think that that's the only approach into achieving your goals. However, I did not hear anything about one of the major sources of emissions of CO2, which is the transport system in the country. Have you done anything to improve systemically that part, that link, very weak link of Poland's economy? And do you think that that may be one of very, very important elements to do that what you are planning to do? And if I may, I would like to extend this question to Mr. Berdin. If you are assigning some funding to Poland, and for example, you know that transportation is one of the major issues for limiting the further growth of that country. Are you considering the subjects in making your decision what kind of research projects are you supporting or not in terms of the needs of the country which gets the money from you even in its academic research? Thank you.
In fact, you addressed two questions in one. The first about the transportation system. We have done some analysis. Unfortunately, it is not completed. So we know what are the perspectives of the emission in this system, but we don't know what to do precisely, and we don't know how much we have to pay to reduce this emission. I'm not talking about only about technology. I mean, less emission vehicles. I'm talking about the change of the transmission system in general. And of course, you know about it because we discussed it during the coffee break. That's the answer. And the other one, I forget.
The other one was basically for Mr.
Yeah, I think so.
In terms of your assigning funding to various projects, let's say, by making your decision, by considering the priorities and the needs of the country that is submitting to you the research project, like, for example, would you consider as a priority, as you hear now, the transportation issue is a major issue for the country? Would you consider that as the priority in assigning research projects or funding the research projects?
I have no funding.
Well, first of all, a good bit of our research is need-oriented, and a good bit of it also addresses national needs. But it has to have high scientific merit, and it has to be at the frontier of science. The one thing that we do not want to do is to get too close to the marketplace when it comes to finding near-term solutions. So we strive to fund transformative research that will lead to new concepts, entirely new concepts, that can lead to new technologies. Now, that will be further in the future. It may be 10, 15, 20 years in the future, and it may not address current problems. But that's why we have a Department of Transportation and a Department of Energy to deal with the nearer-term problems. The Science Foundation is really a grants agency primarily to support relatively basic science, and that's what we try to keep focused on.
Thank you. I suggest that we stop the discussion.
Mr. President, may I be granted with one remark? There is not red lamp on the
yes,
on the
please,
post.
Please go ahead.
And the one remark is about money. This all what I've showed to you, it'll cost money, and it'll cost something like 10 billion euro yearly. And to compare, not with the United States budget, which is definitely much higher, but with the situation in Poland, our investment ratio is 23 billion euro yearly. So we will have to rise this about 4% as a significant effort without transport, and we should have add a transport to this. So it's something like rebuilding country after the war. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We can be back at the discussion of this point later. But now I take a great pleasure to announce the next speaker, who is Dr. Stephen Rotler, Chief Technology Officer and Vice President of Science and Technology at Sandia National Laboratories. Dr. Rotler.
Thank you. It's quite a privilege to be invited to speak with you this afternoon, and I appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the work we do at Sandia, and with a special emphasis on our international collaborations and why they're important to a U.S. national laboratory, and in particular why they're so important to my institution. I recognize that I have the unenviable task of being the final speaker standing between you and a relaxing reception, so I promise to work very hard to make my comments deep but brief and try to limit my presentation here to about 10 minutes or so. I'm going to be speaking about Sandia National Laboratories because that's the institution I know best and it's the institution I represent, but I want to give just a little bit of context before I start talking about my own lab, and that is that the Department of Energy has some 21, I believe is the number, 21 national laboratories and technical centers. I think the actual count is 17 national laboratories and 4 technical centers. Those national laboratories are quite varied in their mission. 10 of them are funded primarily by the Office of Science. 3 of them, my laboratory, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and Los Alamos National Laboratory, are funded primarily but not completely by the National Nuclear Security Administration. And in fact, as you'll see in a moment, the National Nuclear Security Administration actually is, while the largest single funding source for my laboratory, they are, in a sense, a minority shareholder in that only 40% of our laboratory's budget is accounted for by the nuclear weapon program today. It's a much different story than if you looked at our lab 10 years ago. The other labs, the four that I didn't mention and the 3 technical centers, are funded by other parts of the Department of Energy. And I would say that, you know, certainly for the 3 NNSA laboratories, there are some significant changes underway that reflect a transition that is intentional in all 3 institutions to move away from an identity as a nuclear weapon laboratory to being a national security laboratory and a laboratory that has an international reputation for contributing to the advancement of science and engineering. We started down this road at Sandia some time ago. We started down this road, to be quite frank about it, in the 1980s as we began to expand the customer base for the laboratories. And through the 1980s and 1990s into the early part of this decade, we experienced cycles in the amount of work that we did for other agencies. And during that period, the laboratory's budget was dominated by the funding that we get from the government for the nuclear weapon program. In the early part of this decade, we made a conscious decision to move the laboratory in a much different direction. We as a result of 2 or 3 years of some pretty intense discussions at the executive level, made a conscious decision to stop identifying ourselves and to not manage ourselves as a nuclear weapon laboratory, but rather as a laboratory that provides capabilities, technologies, engages in research and development that supports the broad national security needs of our country. We also made a conscious decision in response to what we could see was happening both domestically and internationally with respect to advancements in science and engineering to significantly broaden our engagement internationally. That creates some challenges for us because much of the work that we do is quite sensitive. The laboratory, most of it, but not all of it, works behind a fence, a secure fence. It's very difficult to bring in visitors, particularly visitors from foreign countries. And we compound that by the fact that for historical reasons and purely historical reasons, we happen to reside on an Air Force base. So we are located literally behind a fence. And that makes it very hard to engage outwardly. And so we've worked very hard to establish structure and facilities outside those fences that make it easier for us to engage internationally, including with countries that this country would consider quite sensitive. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how we've made that journey and some of the tools that we use. I think one of the speakers earlier referred to the fact that he was talking about tools. I'm going to talk about tools that we've personalized for ourselves. I think conceptually these tools could work for other institutions, but would obviously have to be personalized to the situation in Poland and to the situation associated with the institution in question. So like the other national laboratory, Sandia is a contractor-operated facility. So the laboratory itself is owned by the government, but it is operated by industry. So I and all of my colleagues at Sandia are not government employees. We are employees of Sandia Corporation, which is a nonprofit organization that at this moment happens to be a part of Lockheed Martin, because Lockheed Martin holds the contract for running Sandia National Laboratories. The laboratory was created in 1949, actually 1948, but it became official in 1949. And what some don't realize is that it was a spinoff of Los Alamos National Laboratory. It wasn't a national lab at the time. We were coming out of World War II and the end of the Manhattan Project. Sandia was known as Z Division of Los Alamos. We were located at Manzano Base, what now is Kirtland Air Force Base, down in Albuquerque. Los Alamos in the late 1940s, the University of California made a decision that they no longer wanted to manage two sites. Didn't want to manage a remote site. They asked the government to find somebody else to manage that site. The government turned to AT&T at the time and asked AT&T to take on the responsibility for managing what eventually became Sandia National Laboratories for a no-fee contract. And AT&T managed the lab until 1993, some 45 years, with no fee having been paid during that period. In 1993, AT&T, you might recall in this country, the AT&T was being broken up. The baby bells, as we referred to them, the utilities, the telephone companies were being divested. AT&T was taking their business in a completely different direction, concluded that managing a place like Sandia really didn't fit with their corporate emphasis any longer. They gave up the contract voluntarily. The government competed it. The contract was won by Martin Marietta, who subsequently merged with Lockheed in 1995, and the lab has been managed by Lockheed ever since. Now, as I mentioned, our laboratory has changed significantly since it was founded in the late 1940s. This chart shows both at a very high level conceptually how our mission has changed, and it also shows how the proportion of nuclear weapon funding at our lab has changed. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, as I said, we were funded 100% by the nuclear weapon program. That was our sole mission. It was the only thing we did. And we were not really a research and development institution like we are today. We were very much an organization focused on production engineering and the manufacturing of nuclear weapons. That's how we started. That's what Z Division did during the Manhattan Project during World War II. In the 1960s and into the 1970s, we began to take on additional responsibilities, first in the 1960s, taking on development engineering for the nuclear weapon program, meaning the engineering of all those things that go around the parts that Los Alamos and Lawrence designed that make a nuclear explosive package a militarily useful item. And into the 1970s, we began to take on other mission responsibilities. In the 1970s, as you'll recall, during the Arab oil embargo, it was a significant energy crisis in this and in other countries. The government shifted significant resources into the development of efficient energy technologies. And at the time, they turned to the national laboratories, principally the three nuclear weapons laboratories, and asked us to help with that. And so we began to see a diversity in our mission space at that time. It started in the 1970s, but moving into the 1980s, we put a big emphasis on building our science base. It was clear to us even then, as I mentioned earlier, that we were going to diversify the funding base at the laboratories, and we recognized that the only way we could do that was to begin to build and invest in research and development at the laboratories. And so we began to emphasize greatly our investments in basic science and in research at the laboratories in the 1970s and 1980s. And then, as I said, as we moved through the 1990s and into this decade, we made a conscious decision to move away from the identity as a nuclear weapon laboratory to take on the identity of a national security laboratory. And to this, you know, as of this year, the nuclear weapon program represents only 40% of the funding that we have at our laboratory, the other 60% being provided by other branches of the government to serve national security needs. And going back to the 1980s and up through today, we make a significant investment in science and technology at the laboratories and in research and development, some of which I'll tell you about. Just to give you a sense, I'm not going to go through, I have three slides here, time doesn't permit me to go through the details of all these projects, but just to give you a sense of the diversity of things that we do at the laboratories, I've got some examples for you. This view graph summarizes projects that we take on principally for the Department of Defense and for the intelligence community here in the States. And it represents, as well as the space program, I should add, and it represents some of the technological developments in our laboratory, some of the things that we're quite proud of and things that we think we're among the very best at. I'd put at the top of that list something you see near the top of this view graph, and that is synthetic aperture radars. Sandia, among other institutions, both private and government here in the States, have pioneered the development of synthetic aperture radars. Sandia's specialty here is in miniaturization and in real-time processing. And we field units we develop units that are used in the field today. Something that's not well known, you see here in the lower left-hand corner, shuttle return to flight. I think everybody is well aware that as a result of the Columbia and Challenger accidents, we now do an inspection of the thermal protection system on the space shuttle after it goes into orbit and just before it deorbits. The sensor and the system that are used for that inspection were developed and fielded by Sandia National Laboratories. Dating back to the 1970s, we also have a fairly significant program in energy technologies and in nonproliferation. Our focus here is one of environmental stewardship, waste repositories, and dealing with low, mid, and high-level nuclear waste. We also have a significant investment provided by the government in assuring a safe, secure, and reliable energy supply and infrastructure, and we're very interested in the relationship between energy production and water usage. That's principally because the part of the country in which our laboratory is located, water is a critical issue and becoming more critical with every passing day, and the government is investing in that. And then, as I said, we have a significant investment in technologies that support the nonproliferation of weapons of mass destruction. A much smaller but growing area for us is work that we do in support of homeland security and defense. Our focus here really is on security applications, and you see a number of them here that I won't go into. We work in a very wide variety of arenas across the U.S. government, working in ports of entry, working at military installations, working at airports, the energy supply infrastructure, as well as critical infrastructure in general. Underpinning all of that work that we do for our customers is a very robust and I consider to be a very healthy science base. In fact, the term we use to describe the way we work at Sandia is science-based engineering. We identify ourselves principally as an engineering laboratory. That's a reflection of the kind of work we do, but also typically where we fit into the life cycle of things that are provided to our customers. But as I said, we started in the 1970s and early 1980s making sure that when we're engaged in programs, when we're conducting engineering, that it has deep roots in a science base that we find at our laboratories and that we get through our partners. And what you see on this view graph across the bottom are a number of research areas, some of which are historical, some of which are rather new. But we call these our research foundations. These are areas that we consciously invest in. We develop and sustain capabilities. We contribute to the scientific literature and to advancements in these areas in support of our missions and in support of advancing science and engineering in general. And then sitting on top of that, what you see are three things that we call strategic capabilities. These are things that represent the integration of some of those research foundations. And three areas of great importance to our laboratory are high-performance computing and simulation, nanotechnologies and microsystems, and extreme environments. We have the ability at our laboratory to simulate physically virtually any kind of extreme environment that you could possibly imagine or possibly be interested in. Something that is very important to us is engaging the broader scientific community. We recognize full well that science can't be accomplished solely by Sandia or solely by working within the confines of the United States. And so we engage very broadly in the external community. We've worked very hard to put into place facilities and centers such as the three that are shown here to facilitate those interactions with the outside world. All three of these facilities, the combustion research facility, which is located at our site in California, the Computer Science Research Institute, and the Center for Integrated Nanotechnologies, which is a joint center created by Sandia and Los Alamos National Laboratory, all of those are located outside the fence and serve as major centers where we bring in people from all over the world to collaborate with us in the advancement of science and engineering. We pursue partnerships on a global scale. This is something that changes year after year. Our international engagement has grown significantly in the last 10 years, and I believe that will only continue. We focus on relationships with universities, other government laboratories, and with industry, and we have a very robust partnership program with each of those segments. On the left-hand side of this view graph, you see icons for a number of universities with which we have deep collaborations. I'll point out that these collaborations vary. Some of them are more organic in nature in the sense that they start and we foster them through principal investigator to principal investigator contact and by funding research at the universities that is of interest to us and that we conduct at the lab. But we also have strategic relationships. These start typically with a strategic level discussion between the two institutions, a determination that we want to formally partner by putting funding from the two institutions into joint efforts. And we do that. And these are both here in the States and internationally. The key ones here are the University of Texas, Tsinghua University in China, the Advanced Industrial Science and Technology, the National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology in Japan, and the National University of Singapore. I'll wrap up by just giving you three quick examples of how we do these collaborations. This is an example of an institute that we've created. It's called the National Institute for Nanoengineering. It's based in Albuquerque. It is a consortium that consists of Sandia, university partners, and industry partners, each bringing funding to the relationship. We sponsor multidisciplinary projects. We bring students and faculty onto our campus to collaborate with our researchers. This program, its principal purpose is to accelerate innovative solutions in the application of nanotechnologies, but we also use it as a way of emphasizing the development of future technical leaders in this area of growing importance. A second example is our partnerships with industry. These take many forms, two of which I'll mention. One is a direct relationship, a direct collaboration. An example of this is our relationship with Goodyear. This is a strategic relationship that started in the early 1990s. The government incentivized that relationship but got out of that in the late 1990s, and now that relationship is funded fully by Goodyear. They put money into the laboratories to the tune of several million dollars a year, and they use the computational technologies and engineering sciences codes that we provide them in the conduct of their business and in the design and production of tires. And I think by their own acknowledgement, the use of those technologies has had a significant impact on their competitiveness. Another example, which is not shown explicitly on this chart, is that Sandia created some 10 years ago a science and technology park outside the confines of the fences there in Albuquerque where we're located. This is a park that we set up in order to draw high-tech industries into the Albuquerque area to partner with our laboratory. We manage the park, but it is actually funded and run through a nonprofit organization that is separate from the laboratories. There are some 27 companies located in this science and technology park. There are close to 3,000 jobs that have been created as a result of that park. The average salary of employees who work in that park is twice the average salary for the city of Albuquerque. These are very valuable jobs and highly sought after by our leaders because of the kind of funding that it brings into the city and the kind of high-tech jobs that it creates. And then the third example is one that's it's a domestic example. This represents a partnership involving multiple national laboratories, Sandia, Lawrence Berkeley, and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, as well as universities. In this case, the University of California, Berkeley, Stanford University, and University of California at Davis. This is a DOE-funded institute. It's called the Joint Bioenergy Institute. It's located not far from Berkeley, right by the Bay Bridge, in fact, on the Berkeley side of the Bay Bridge. The principal focus of this institute is on the development and advancement of biofuels technologies. These institutions come together. A facility was built. Actually, I guess we've leased a facility there in the area. And we, each of these organizations has staff in residence at that facility. So it is a jointly run, jointly managed, jointly staffed operation, all focused on a single mission, which is research and development in the area of biofuels to advance those technologies in support of our national needs. And then I'll end with this final view graph. This is a summary of some of the international collaborations that we have under development now. We literally engage with countries around the world. We have, as you've already seen, significant engagements in China, Japan, Singapore, Western Europe. I'm not aware of any significant interactions with Poland, but the reason we're here is because we're very interested in looking at what possibilities might exist in collaborating with Poland. We have, interestingly enough, for a lab like ours, we have significant interactions in the Middle East as well. We have a joint research center that we maintain in Amman, Jordan, with the Jordanian government to sponsor joint research in security in the Middle East. And with that, I'll close. Be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Rotler, for the presentation of your internationally so well-known research laboratory. And we can accommodate, again, a question or two. Yes.
It's really a quite impressive presentation. How big is the laboratory? You know, just, if you tell, you know, just in the size of the amount of people, it is not a secret. That's the one question. And the second, you know, just with all this project which you have, and I heard here during these presentations today that Poland has a 95% electric energy from coal. You are sitting here probably on 500 years of the energy supply to the whole world in a coal here in this country. Do you work on a clean energy from coal? You know, just there is a lot of things which can be done. Maybe this is a really a big challenge for the institution for a common project between Poland and the United States and your laboratory.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can answer both of those questions. The first question is very simple. The second one's a bit more complicated. The answer to your first question is that our laboratory has about 8,000 full-time employees and an annual budget of about, I think this year it'll be around $2.4 to $2.5 billion. So that's the size of the laboratory. And I should say, I meant to say it earlier, we maintain two sites. Most of our employees are located in Albuquerque, New Mexico. On order of 7,000 of our employees are located in Albuquerque. We have close to another 1,000 that are located in Northern California in the Livermore Valley. In fact, they're located right across the street from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, if you happen to have been there. We have about another 3,000 contractor associates that work at the laboratory as well. The second question is a bit more complicated. The answer to the simple answer to your question is yes, we do have programs here in the U.S. and we have a small program at Sandy, and we are very interested in clean coal technologies. In fact, it's I forget the name of the individual who was here earlier, but she is a staff member on a committee that is chaired by the senior senator from my state, and this is an area of intense interest to Jeff, Senator Jeff Bingaman. The reason the answer is a bit more complicated is that you heard me speak about the assignment of an energy mission to the three NNSA laboratories in the 1970s. We of course are going through another crisis in this country where there are some increased investments in the development of energy technologies, and to try and reduce our dependence on foreign oil and also to address some pretty serious climate issues. It's not clear to me what the government will do in terms of who they will turn to deal with this problem. The early indicators are that they are not going to turn to the national laboratories as the primary source of that. The early indicators to me are that the government's looking more closely at working with industry and universities as their primary source, their primary supplier for this, with the national laboratories providing support. But it's too early to tell. We have some funding from the government. Someone asked me earlier if our budget wasn't growing like crazy with the money going into energy in this country, and I said, interestingly enough, it's not. And that's because the government, I think, is not, at least not yet, turning to the three nuclear weapons laboratories as a primary supplier for this like they did in the 70s. There are many more choices in this country right now. And it appears to me right now the government is focused primarily on moving technologies as fast as possible into implementation, which of course is not something that the National Laboratory specialize in. We're an organization you would turn to if you wanted to work, you know, very early in the life cycle.
Thank you. Any other questions or points raised by the audience? At this point, we could feel free to direct questions to any of the speakers in this session. Yes, please, go ahead.
But the Earth is one and the climate is one. So it doesn't matter how far you are. We are contribute to the same planet.
Ladies and gentlemen, should I take it as a sign that we approach the end of the discussion in this session? As you know, we will have another chance now to raise any issue you may like. Chuck, Dr. Westner, are we supposed now to have the round table discussion? Well, try to close your eyes and we will try to figure out that we are sitting around the round table.
Well, it's a good discussion. I think we should
continue. Yes, absolutely.
I gave a very short answer to the question of this gentleman having to do with national needs because I didn't want to take too much time. But now that we have a little time, we do have a joint program with Canada in advanced automotive technologies. And again, we're looking at new frontier concepts involving energy technologies, cyber-physical systems, combustion science could play a role, including advanced fuel cell technology. You'd think the fuel cells, having been around for so long, there's not much left to explore, but that's not the case at all. There's still room for advanced materials. And I think material science and engineering is ubiquitous around the world. There's always an application for advanced material science, which is why every country now is pursuing a nanotechnology to exploit opportunities at that scale. With regard to energy and national needs in energy, we have taken a different tack from biocatalysis, and we're looking at high-temperature inorganic catalysis and catalytic processes that can convert cellulose and lignin directly to gasoline. In other words, bypassing ethanol and butanol altogether and going directly to gasoline. That has some obvious advantages, and it looks like it's practical. We've been able to work with industry and carrying some of this up to sort of a semi pilot scale. And my guess is that this technology will see significant investment over the next 10 years. So in those regards, also we work with small businesses through our small business Innovation Research Program, SBIR, and in certain thematic areas that again address national needs, we support basic research in small businesses, not large businesses, in the U.S. in order to reduce scientific risk to ready new technologies for the marketplace. And so we do play a very direct role in supporting innovation. And perhaps the most important role we play is the graduate students that we support through research by the integration of research with education, because those graduate students, if they're not going into academia, if they go into the private sector, will transfer that technology directly into the private sector and will be able to make a contribution to new product and new process innovations. But even if they go to academia, they're also part of the nation's innovation system, and they can carry out research along the same lines that will lead to new concepts and will lead to new technologies that can provide economic benefit. So in all those ways, the foundation, even though our focus is at the frontier, are always looking at ways of taking new concepts and converting them into value through partnerships primarily.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Dr. Kleiber, perhaps we could just add Dr. Kulik and Dr. Proenza to this existing panel if they would like to contribute. I think there's at least one chair there, and we can easily make two. So if we can just proceed in this informal fashion, we can just continue the discussion. And could I ask you, sir, to see if either of them would like to raise a particular point in summation, with the promise to our audience that wine and beer is very near.
So I understand we start now our last round of discussions today. And am I right that we have a speaker, the director of the University of Warsaw, of Technical University of Warsaw? Yes, Professor Kulik, go ahead.
Good afternoon. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation for this very interesting conference. I am for the first time attending this conference. Actually, if we talk about the role of university authorities, I would say that at the level of research, actually we don't have too much to work, because our professors have personal contacts at conferences, and I have many examples of collaboration between professors of my university, Warsaw University of Technology, and Americans. One of the most spectacular achievements was in the last years, for instance, collaboration with Cummins Filtration. Our Professor Gradon, actually he won a world competition for the best filters. He used nanotechnology and so on, so now millions of these filters are produced in America according to our invention. Actually, we have much more to do if we talk about education and transfer of technology. So we have several agreements. Even this time, I'm taking advantage that after this conference, we will have some talks about collaboration with University of Maryland and so on. But now we have not much time, so I would like to raise only one issue which was not raised. I'm surprised because I am not specialist in this, and I would like to address this idea maybe to authorities at the highest level. I am very happy that our ministry has five priorities, and actually three of five refer to human beings, some directly, some indirectly. So as you could notice, health is very important. Actually, if we talk about quality of life depends on health, and nobody asked the question why we observe such great disease of cancer. Actually, I like very much the presentation. Unfortunately, the lady who presented is not here. A lot of statistical data. And one of the first slides was very, very striking, because she showed that during the last 50 years, practically the same amount of Americans die on cancer. So simple calculation gives us the death rate 0.2%, about 200 people for 100,000 population. And of course, and we know that during these 50 years, it was big, enormous improvement of diagnosis and treatment. So what does it mean? it means that the number of patients increases dramatically, maybe exponentially. This data was missing. And let's ask the question, why? There are a lot of factors, but one of very important factors, I was thinking about this long time ago already, is food. I mean, worse and worse food. And I would propose, among many bridges which we can establish between Poland and America, I would propose ecological food. This idea is not new. Italy, for instance, tries to introduce this so-called slow food. It means produced by traditional way, not but using industrial way, where the food is cheaper and cheaper, but worse and worse. Actually, I think it's much better to prevent the disease than to treat the disease. And Poland is very well prepared. Some officials, even from Ministry of Agriculture, they say, okay, our agriculture is behind Europe, Western Europe. I think, thanks to God, we have very good agriculture because we have very not poisoned land. So we have a lot of land for farming and good quality. And we also have a lot of farmers. I mean, a lot of Polish population lives in villages. Mm-hmm. So we are very well prepared for production using traditional way, introducing maybe the achievements of science and technology, because now we can combine these two things, traditional way and achievements of technology, just for production, good food, to prevent this kind of disease. Because it's much cheaper and much better just to pay more for food than for medical treatment and for medicines. A lot of people spend a lot of money for handmade products. Why not to spend more money for good food? This is my idea, which I am addressing to all ministers which are present here. And Mr.
Thank you. Could we pass now the mic to Professor Prunza?
Well, perhaps I can comment more broadly, because certainly the issue of food is an important one, and one of the most important aspects of that has been the growing population and how to serve it, and the whole Green Revolution is a case in point. Let me go back to the role of universities and the interaction between universities and their communities and their governments, because I think, again, we've seen today a number of examples, and especially appreciate the new Minister of Science and Higher Education in Poland having shared the strategies there. As we look across the world, virtually every nation and within subsegments, whether it's a conglomerate, a republic such as the United States, within a nation like this or within the European Union, there's almost nearly universal adherence now to how do we best align the opportunities and needs of an economy with the strengths that are inherent within a nation, whether it's in natural resources and opportunities or in terms of course, the increasing dependence on human capital and knowledge and conceptual innovation to go forward. As such, what we're seeing is an incredible number of experiments of this alignment taking place around the world. And that's why I said that I believe that the message I wanted to leave you with, and certainly perhaps we want to explore some questions, is that we face common challenges. There's a common set of toolboxes. Occasionally we see a new tool. But what is unique is the application of those opportunities to specific settings that reflect their strengths, opportunities, and weaknesses. And I think we have a lot of opportunity for common learning and display of great wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you. As usual, we can accommodate some comments or questions. Yes, Professor Domański.
Well, we missed one thing during the discussion. Could you use the mic? It's very yes.
It sounds great. Yeah. We missed one thing I noticed. We are talking about the energy conversion processes and the future of the world. We should look at the problem of hydrogen economy. We have not discussing today about the sources for hydrogen production, if you would like to have it, for transportation, for energy generation, power generation. And the second problem is a very important, it's energy storage. Energy storage is a very nice way to improve overall efficiency of a system. We missed it somehow. And of course, the energy storage for hydrogen. These new ideas connected with hydrogen storage. We have a big problem how we can apply such a nice source of energy, hydrogen, for transportation, because we have a weak storage. And the question to the United States partner, are you considered the high-temperature gas cool reactor for the coal gasification and hydrogen production?
Thank you. This is true. We didn't somehow discuss the problem of hydrogen-related energy issues, except that I mentioned that as a very important problem in my introduction. Yes, please. Yes, Professor Monsas.
I feel reprimanded, therefore I ask for the opportunity. Yes, we did discuss hydrogen, we just didn't have time to get into details of it. Underground coal processing with a reactor, of course, catalytic reactor, is the way to get hydrogen. Hydrogen in transportation, I don't know about it, is a tricky problem, although some buses are running in Poland on hydrogen today. Beautiful example. And energy storage, yes, we did address energy storage. I talk about electric car. There is no better energy storage than electric cars, tens of millions of them, charged at night when we don't need the energy in industry in everyday use, and then using the energy during the day. So we did touch on it.
Thank you. And yes, Professor, yes. And I'm sorry, but I was told that we should be coming to an end of the session. So this would be the last intervention.
Very, very brief comment to Professor Kulik's remark regarding cancer and stimulation by food. Even more than food, at least on the same level, we need water and air. And in fact, water is contaminated with all the xenobiotics which come from extensive use of medicines and drugs. And then I think this is a very, very basic issue which could be the good topic for collaboration, American-Polish collaboration. And both sides have the same problem, and there's also a scarcity of water in some areas, as President Rutter said, and then contaminated water is the source of contaminated air through aerosol formation, and so this is another topic I would like to propose.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think I'd like to first ask for. Let me first thank this panel for. I think really an excellent contribution and exactly the type of dialogue we wanted to encourage. I think without any self-congratulation, we can mutually congratulate ourselves on accomplishing what Dr. Kleiber described when we began this morning. I must say from my own perspective that I welcome the clear accomplishment, the considerable potential, the enthusiasm and openness of our Polish colleagues. I very much hope that it has been registered on our Polish guests that, there's a joke about Americans. They don't fool around, Some of the offers that you have here for working with Sandia National Laboratory, for collaborating with the National Cancer Institute, for working with the National Science Foundation, they're not kidding. As I joked earlier, the only thing they bring is expertise, agility, and a lot of money. All of those are very useful. And lastly, I think there's been a recurrent theme, and that is two. One, clearly, the common challenges we face on this planet. This is an exciting time, and I just hope we don't want to be in a time of the Chinese curse where they condemn you, wishing you to live in exciting times. It's certainly better than the last century, however, though I think we would generally agree with that. So I would first say that I think there have been a number of themes identified here that provide common challenges, and there's clearly the goodwill to collaborate on those. And let me say something very banal, but I think very important. These meetings are not intended to be one-off, a term that I'm sure none of you are familiar with. It's not intended to be kiss and run. What we would like to do is build a relationship here. Not only emails, but telephones work between Poland and the United States. But they have to be exercised to do so. And I think you have an open door here with a number of people. And I think you've been able to understand that the systems are open and receptive. I would also have two small housekeeping points, if I may make them. One, just to reiterate that at 6:45, at P and 16th Street, you'll find the Carnegie Institution with the wonderful show that they'll be there tonight. And lastly, I would urge that you be here. We have invited White House officials to join us again for tomorrow, and we will be happy to offer you coffee and croissant in the morning. And we'd like to start promptly at 9 o'clock. And for those of you who have felt frustrated, let me reassure you, tomorrow is going to be in a much more discursive fashion. We'll be around a large table to encourage greater discussion. And if you have no further comments, Dr. Kleiber,
I would have a lot of comments, but I will try to formulate them tomorrow then.
All right. Great. I didn't think you would be at an absence for words. So could I invite you all to do something we sometimes fail to do? If we move collectively out of this room, which has become stuffy, there is a hall, which we call the Great Hall for good reason, and we'd be happy to offer you a variety of refreshments and some nourishment. Thank you very much.